Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On February 19th, 1963, the groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique, by Betty Friedan was published 50 years ago. The book is credited with igniting the second wave of American feminism of the 60s. Betty Friedan frankly talked about the, quote, problem with no name and challenged the conventional role for suburban white women as housewives and mothers. She wrote, quote, each suburban wife struggles with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to ask, even of herself, the silent question, is this all? In response, Betty Friedan was flooded with responses. This one from Cam Stivers was typical. Cam was a 25-year-old wife and mother who thought her life was over until she read the book in 1963. She wrote, quote, I had everything a woman was supposed to want, marriage to a nice, dependable guy, a wonderful little kid, a nice house in the suburbs, and I was miserable, end quote. So 50 years after the publication of this groundbreaking book, where are we today? Stephanie Kuntz says the emotions and experiences of the women who responded most fervently to what Betty Friedan had to say are poorly understood today, even by their own daughters and granddaughters. In her book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s, Stephanie Kuntz writes, quote, whatever the limits of Friedan's book for today's readers, her insistence on the need to break down prevailing assumptions about women, work, family, and to look for societal origins of dilemmas that are often experienced as purely personal remains extremely relevant. Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and is director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Rose.
It's great to have you.
Thanks.
We are also joined by Leslie Bell, a sociologist and psychotherapist who specializes in women's development and sexuality. Leslie is out with a new book called Hard to Get, 20-something Women and the Paradox of Sexual Freedom. And Leslie writes, quote, young women may appear to have more choices than ever before, but the opening up of cultural notions of what is acceptable for women generates great confusion, uncertainty, and anxiety, end quote. And Leslie Bell is here in studio. Hi, Leslie. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
So why don't we start off by going a little bit back in time? And Stephanie, you do such a great job of really explaining what the political environment was like in the 50s. Well, actually, also in the 60s. You write that on December 22nd, 1962, 1 month before the Feminine Mystique hit the bookstores, the Saturday Evening Post pushed a cover article about the typical American woman. Again, this is 1962, 35 years old, two children, hoping for a third, and was a full-time homemaker. She completed slightly more than 3 years of high school and had been happily married for 14 years. And unstated though this was, she was white. So tell us a little bit about that time, right before the book hit the bookstores.
Well, it's funny because nowadays we think of the 60s as a time of liberation, but in fact, the first half of the 60s was, you know, it might as well be 1396 to most young women. And it's really not until the 1970s that we begin to see some of these attitudes change. That Saturday Evening Post article that you talked about claimed that almost all women believed that a man, as one woman put it, a woman needs a master-slave relationship, whether it's a boss and employee or husband-wife. Now, of course, there were many women who didn't think this way, but who thought there was something wrong with them. And as you say, you know, this 1963, both the values and the laws were just absolutely stunning. This was a period where if you did want to work, you had to turn to the help wanted female section of the want ads, and it was perfectly legal to write things. I discovered ads in the New York Times of that year that said, you must be really beautiful to win this job.
<You know? laughs>
Women then, it was perfectly legal to pay them extra, to pay them lower wages, to deny them promotions, to ask them about their plans, to fire them if they got married or pregnant, as the flight attendants used to be. One woman who did have a child and didn't tell a stewardess and didn't tell her employer, when the employer found out, they offered her a choice of resigning immediately or putting her child in an orphanage.
Wow.
But, you know, one of the big myths is that homemakers were better off then. And, in fact, that is not true either. There were only 8 states in the country where a homemaker had any claim at all upon the income earned by her husband during the marriage, even if she had enabled his job. And even in those community property states, he had the right to alienate community property or sell his share of it, as she did not, and to decide what could be done with it. There were head and master laws giving him the right to decide where they live. And, you know, the legal definition of rape in those days was forcible intercourse with someone other than the man's wife. Mm.
It is kind of amazing when you think this was just 40 years ago. You write that in many states, a woman was obliged to take her husband's surname. Banks and credit card companies discriminated against single women. In Illinois, Marshall Field's department store would allow a woman to use her first name with her husband's surname if she could prove she had an independent source of income. But in no case could she use her maiden name, explained a credit card department spokesman, because, quote, she no longer exists as a person under her maiden name. I mean, it's easy to forget that these laws and these policies were on the books just 40 years ago.
It is, you know, and when people reread the feminine mystique today, they're often surprised by the fact that it doesn't have a lot of discussion about the issues that became central to the women's movement: equal pay, get rid of these laws, reproductive rights. She spent most of her book just trying to convince people of something that sounds so obvious to us today. The first excerpt from her book that appeared in Good Housekeeping magazine had the title, and, you know, as you know, editors always try to choose the most provocative title possible. So this title was, it starts belligerently with the words, "I say," and then the rest of the sentence is, "Women are people too."
Hmm.
And, you know, it was a radical thing to say then, because the whole idea, in fact, leading psychiatrists of the day said that the worst thing society can do is treat its citizens primarily as people instead of primarily as different males and females.
And I love that you include excerpts of letters in the beginning of your book, Stephanie. Another one is from Constance Ahrens. She dropped out of college to have a child, and as a young wife and mother in the early 60s, she was seen a psychiatrist for depression. Halfway through the feminine mystique, she got up and flushed her tranquilizers down the toilet. She wrote, quote, "The thoughts I had were terrible. I wished for another life. I woke up and started to clean and wash clothes and was miserable. No one seemed to understand. My friends didn't feel that way. I just assumed I'd be punished in some way. That's what happens to women who are selfish. My friend said, 'You're so selfish.'" And did you find this over and over again? Because it seems like these were the themes.
Absolutely. The most common thing I was told in the interviews I did was, "I thought I must be crazy." Mm. And that was what was so liberating about Frieda. And, you know, when I first started writing this book, Rose, I was sort of disappointed in the book. I'd really thought I'd read it. And it's funny, because I thought I'd read it only because my mother had read it and used to call me and tell me how indignant it made her. But when I went back to it myself, it was like, oh, my goodness, this is kind of a boring book. It's so dated. But then I did these interviews with almost 200 women and men who had read the book at the time. And it was, even as a historian who knew, you know, I thought, how bad it was back in the 60s, it was stunning. The pain, the self-doubt, the self-blame that these women had internalized, until somebody came along and said, "This is not your individual problem. It's because you're not being allowed to utilize your full capacities, and you have needs and desires not other than, but in addition to, being a family person."
That is Stephanie Kuntz. She is author of the book A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. We're also joined by Leslie Bell. She's out with a new book, Hard to Get, 20-something Women and the Paradox of Sexual Freedom. And we'll talk, Leslie, later in the show about just, you know, where we are 50 years later and how we have more choices than ever. But as you find with the women that you interview, there's so much anxiety and confusion around that. When you look back 50 years ago and look at the impact this book had, what goes through your mind?
Well, I'm certainly influenced a lot by Stephanie Kuntz's work, and I wasn't alive at the time that the book was written, so it's in retrospect that I'm thinking about it. And yeah, I'm struck by, again, how isolated all of these women felt, and surprising though it may seem, the young women I spoke with today similarly feel as though the dilemmas that they're wrestling with, which are not so much about whether they can have a successful career and advance in their education, but how to manage that freedom along with developing a personal life, how alone they feel in those dilemmas still. And again, it may have been, it's gotten flipped a little bit. But again, it's not seeing this as a phenomenon that exists in the culture or that's caused by anything structural. It's perceived very much as an individual issue.
And how relevant is Betty Friedan's book for what women are facing today? We found an interesting article in The Guardian by Ellie Mae O'Hagan, and she wrote, "The most amazing and miserable aspect of the feminine mystique is how relevant it still is. Women of my generation are still being sold lies to keep us obedient. We're told that we're valued until we accused a revered man of rape. We're told we're equal, and yet we still do most of the low-paid and unpaid work. We're told we're respected, and yet we're harassed in the street, objectified, and ridiculed in the media."
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And those mixed messages predominate for women of all ages, but particularly the young women I was speaking with. This time of the 20s is a time of ostensible freedom, where you can do anything in terms of your career and in terms of your personal development. So you can have sex, and in fact, that's a great way to sort of feel powerful, but you better not have sex with too many partners or you're going to cross over a line. Most women couldn't define what that line would actually, what that number would actually be. For some, it was one. You can, you know, sort of spend your 20s not having a relationship, but you'd better be sure to be married by the time you're 30. Those prescriptions are still pretty powerful.
I was surprised, actually, in reading your book, you interview a number of 20-somethings. I didn't realize that, I guess living in the Bay Area, a lot of these women said, I have to be married by 30.
Yeah.
And that was kind of shocking for me to hear.
Oh, the pressure is profound. And these are women who are in the Bay Area, actually. They didn't all grow up here. Most of them didn't. Or they're not exclusively in the Bay Area. They're in Northern California. But yes, the pressure to be married by the time you're 30 is quite strong. You know, there's an episode from Friends from many years ago where one of the characters does the math about when she wants to have children and how soon she should need to be married. And she counts backwards and realizes she needs to be married tomorrow if she's going to sort of live out all of these plans that she has.
And Stephanie, what are your thoughts about the relevancy of the book today? Going back to the piece in The Guardian, Ellie Mae O'Hagan writes, "Like Friedan's, our feminism is stifled by the belief that the battles have been won and we are free to enjoy equality and all of its male-sanctioned glory." I love that line.
Well, I agree with that line. I do think that it's extremely important to understand how far we have come, mm-hmm. and what a difference it has made to have a woman's, to have had a woman's movement. Because I do think sometimes that people actually disempower themselves by thinking that nothing has changed, and things have really changed. I mean, yes, women may still do more unpaid work, but they don't do the double shift that they used to do. Men are really increasingly stepping up to the plate. Rapes and sexual assaults have gone down by 70%. Domestic violence has decreased by 53%. These are real gains that we should not forget. They're gains that came from a movement that not only changed the laws but changed people's attitudes. But the movement, but the part that I agree with and the part that I think Leslie is talking about is we haven't completed that revolution. It's an unfinished revolution, and there are still mopping up operations to do, and to the extent that people believe we have completed it, they're more likely then to turn it inward so that we do get what Leslie was saying, almost a replication of what happened to Friedan's housewives, and that is that people think, well, this must be my problem if we have equality. Why am I not solving this right? Or it might be my partner's problem. One thing that Friedan said that I thought was quite perceptive, she said, sometimes a woman will look around and blame her partner. She'll think she needs a new home, a new husband. No, the problem is she needs to confront the ways that she has been stifled. So I think that's very important, and that part's relevant. But when I assign this book to my students, The only chapter they really related to, and this is why it's great to have Leslie on the show as well, was the sexual cell chapter. That emphasis that somehow you have to, that consumerism and sexuality and all these mixed messages about women get all wrapped up together in what I call now the new feminine mystique, the hottie mystique.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's Stephanie Kuntz. She's author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. We are also joined by Leslie Bell. She's out with a new book, Hard to Get, 20-something Women and the Paradox of Sexual Freedom. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about how far we've come and haven't come 50 years after the groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique, by Betty Friedan. She spoke frankly about the, quote, problem with no name, and challenged the conventional role for suburban women as housewives and mothers. And we'd love to hear from you. If you read this book, if it had an effect on you, talk about your story. And if you remember, if the book maybe came up later in life for you, what was that like? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Do you remember some of these laws that we are talking about? In 1972, the New York Times ran a story about a woman who could not rent an apartment until her husband, a patient in a mental hospital, signed the lease. And there are just so many laws that really restrict women just 40 years ago. So how far have we really come, and what does progress mean in the year 2013? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And before we get into the conversation just about what women today are facing, Stephanie, I wanted to ask you about the criticisms against Betty Friedan, and that is that she focused on problems facing privileged white middle-class women and really didn't pay attention to working women or women of color. And you actually write about what it was like for you to wrestle with this, and you talked about it with your agent.
Well, yes, I struggled with this. You know, my training as a young woman, my mother was the one who read The Feminine Mystique. She was a housewife, and it really resonated for her. But I was away at college, and what I was passionate about in those days was the civil rights movement. So when I went back to The Feminine Mystique and realized how she'd left white working class women out and African American women out, I was initially very disappointed. And I still think that it's extremely important to recognize that she was speaking to a fairly, you know, this was not the full woman's movement. Now, to her credit, 3 years later, when she helped found the National Organization for Women, she co-wrote its principles with Polly Murray, an African-American feminist attorney, and raised some really good demands that applied for all women. But this particular book was just directed at one layer of women, and I came to realize that they actually really needed it. As long as we don't pretend that it was directed at everyone, it's really important to understand that this was a generation of women kind of caught between two worlds, that they were... It used to be that physicians actually said that if a woman spent too much time studying, the blood was diverted from her uterus to her brain. So it was not acceptable for women to get an education in a college. At the turn of the century, in the early years, decades, women who went to college were actually feminists because they were defying the constraints and they were being non-respectable. And then, of course, today you go to college and you expect to use it in the job. But this in-between layer of women was being told, yes, you should go to college. For the first time, it's perfectly respectable to go to college, but your primary reason is to make you a better wife or mother. And the result is that they would get their minds opened to new possibilities. They would see, they would be excited by ideas. They would see what the young men that they were in classes with were doing, even though they were worse students than they often. And then they would be told the door slammed shut. And that's what my agent said when I wrote to her. And she said, it doesn't matter if they had privileges. They were outside looking in and tortured by it. And in some ways, and this was really confirmed by the interviews I had with many women, the very fact that they knew they were privileged. These were not just bored temper tantrum women. They knew they were privileged, and that made them all the more miserable. They would say things like, you know, how can I be so unhappy? You know, my husband doesn't hit me the way my grandmother was hitting. I live so much better than my mother. I know of, one woman said to me, there were Negroes, but, you know, this is 63 when you use the word Negro. There were Negroes being beaten up down south. There were kids starving in Appalachia. What right did I have to be so miserable? And as Leslie can probably confirm, when you've been, with her therapeutic background, it does not help to know that you shouldn't feel miserable. In fact, that tends to make you feel more miserable. So Friedan did, I think, a very good service. The one thing that makes me sad that she didn't do, or maybe felt she couldn't do, given the racism of the time, was to point out that actually African-American women provided a wonderful model of women who, despite the horrible racism and bad work experiences, could prove that you could be a worker, a community activist, and a loving and loved wife and mother at the same time.
You rarely hear about this. You write that it was black activists, not white feminists, who first referred to women and men as co-breadwinners. And historian Linda Gordon, studying female activists at the end of the 19th century, found that while 34% of white activists combined marriage with life as a public figure, 85% of black female activists had found marriage compatible with their activism. So they were saying, well, duh, this is what we're doing, right?
I mean, that's right.
But you rarely hear about that today. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I part of it is the way that African Americans have been written out of history, and particularly African American women. And, you know, it's puzzling because often you will get people, even in the African American community, who will say, well, black women would have loved to have the problems that Friedan's women complained about. They would have loved to stay home. But that's not true. Actually, there's some very interesting series of studies that show that the women, it was the upper white middle class women were the least likely to work outside the home. But upper middle class black women were the most likely, the ones whose husbands could have afforded to keep them home, who had that choice, were the ones who actually made the choice to work full-time. And so this is, I think, a very important part of combining women's history with black history and realizing what a tremendous set of role models are available there.
Well, let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is Kathleen. I am president of the National Association of Women Business Owners in San Francisco, but Betty Friedan's work and Gloria Steinem's completely changed my life. I'm 61, and as a result of that book, I went back to graduate school. My parents at the time told me I would ruin my marriage because I was branching out of what my expected role was, and I did. But at the same time, you know, I knew I had to fulfill my life. And as a result of the recent comments made prior to the elections, I realized that we've still got so much work to do. And really, it's important to do it with all of us, women of color, everyone. We need to, our collective voice is much stronger. And there's so much, you know, that still needs to be done. And so I've decided to go back to law school at 61.
Wow. Good for you.
I'm in the process of applying, and the whole impetus for this for me is my advocacy work for women and girls. Mm. And so I'm very excited, and I'm delighted to hear this program today and can't wait to read the books. And
well, thank you so much, Kathleen. That's so inspiring.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for calling in. And we're going to take a quick break, but we'd love to hear from you if you have a similar story. If you read the book, what effect did it have on you? As Kathleen said, we do have we have further to go. Obviously, we've made so many gains. We have so many more choices. But where are we right now? How far have we come? How far haven't we come 50 years after the feminine mystique? And when you think about the word progress, we hear that a lot. What does that really mean in 2013? It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa,
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we will discuss coverage of the $85 billion mandatory cuts that are set to begin tomorrow. We will also talk about the campaign Fix the Debt. This is a right-wing corporate PR campaign trying to influence budget talks backed by a number of billionaires and millionaires. The Center for Media and Democracy is out with a new report on this, so we'll talk about that tomorrow with PR Watch's Mary Batari and David K. Johnston, and investigative journalist. NPR's Silvia Poggioli will join us from Rome to talk about the elections in Italy. And then on Monday, we'll have a conversation with the co-host of Democracy Now!, Juan Gonzalez, about the new documentary Harvest of Empire. It takes a look at why so many people migrated from Central and South America to the United States. It looks at U.S. foreign policy. The film opens tomorrow, so hopefully it'll open in your area. Be sure to check it out, and we'll have that talk on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about where we are 50 years after the groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique, hit bookstores. This book by Betty Friedan frankly talked about the, quote, problem with no name, and challenged the conventional role for suburban women as housewives and mothers. And today we're joined by Stephanie Kuntz, author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. She teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. We're also joined by Leslie Bell. She's out with a new book called Hard to Get, 20-something Women and the Paradox of Sexual Freedom. Leslie is a sociologist and psychotherapist who specializes in women's development and sexuality. And if you'd like to join us, if you read The Feminine Mystique, if it had an impact on your life, we'd love to hear your story. How far have we come? How far haven't we come? What do you, when you think about feminism today, what does that mean to you? And what does progress mean to you? The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And before we get back to calls, I just wanted to ask you, Leslie, because you do work with so many young women, I often have a hard time looking at, you know, how far we've come, because it's amazing when I look at what my mom did, got married at 20, had a kid at 21. That was really the only choice she had, didn't go to college. And I look at the choices I have. I mean, it's incredible. But then I look at the statistics about, you know, paid time off, the fact that 87% of U.S. counties have no abortion provider. So many women live making minimum wage. It's just hard to square the two. How do you deal with that?
It is hard to square the two. It's a strange set of conditions to be juxtaposed next to each other. And the women that I spoke with were all college educated, so they're more in the kind of demographic that you're describing. I was interested in those women because they are the ones who have benefited most from all of the gains of the feminist movement. But as you point out, there's huge swaths of the population who don't have access to all of those freedoms. And, you know, those have been institutionalized, but they benefit people disproportionately depending on their access to it, depending on their capacity to get a higher degree. I mean, education really is sort of the gateway into whether you then have all of these other freedoms in terms of professional life and everything else. But you're absolutely right. It's a very bizarre world to live in.
Right. I mean, you look at 40 million Americans don't earn a single sick day. Women of color are the majority. Half of all mothers of newborns don't receive any income during their maternity leave. A quarter have to return to work within 8 weeks of giving birth. More than 500,000 in 4 weeks or less. I mean, I could just go down a ton of these kinds of statistics.
Right.
Looking at how far we haven't really come.
Right. And we live in, you know, we live in a country that privatizes our access to all of that, right? So if you are someone who has a high earning job and can afford, either your workplace provides you with leave when you have a child, or you're able to afford to take off extra time, you can do that for yourself. But we don't live in a country that provides that for everyone, right? I mean, in other countries like France, where there's a childcare, or not just childcare, but once
No, go ahead.
Okay. There's a an income supplement that happens once you have a child, which makes these seem then like issues for all women as opposed to issues for poor women. Basically, upper right. and upper middle class women subsidize their own freedoms as opposed to having it provided for everyone.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Lori in Santa Cruz. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How you doing? So
good,
nice
thanks.
To actually talk to you. I listen to you all the time in the background while I'm doing a million other things. I wanted to relate one of my story. I was graduated from high school 64, married my high school boyfriend when I was 19, had a baby at 20, pregnant at 25, and when I had that baby, I had to fight to have a tubal ligation. This was 1972, and I had to have my husband's permission for surgery.
Wow. In 72?
In 72. So we've come a ways, but, you know, when you look back to see where we were before, I guess, you know, you could say, yes, I guess we've come a ways, but, yeah. Permission in 1972 at a very big, respectable, you know, hospital, I'll say it, Kaiser Permanente. So that was their policy in that year.
So how did that work? Did he have to sign a form or come
yes,
in?
Yes, he did. He signed a form.
Wow. What if you had? But what if you were divorced, or what if?
I have no idea. And well, the other issue was that I was 25, so I was told again and again and again and again that you know I had to go before a psychologist to make sure I wasn't crazy and have that signed off. And you know that was. I mean, I'm in California. I'm in you know kind of liberal California.
Yeah, kind of.
Those things happened when I was 25.
You know, and let me ask you this, Lori. I mean, this is such an amazing... I'd love to interview you about that. What do you think about the feminist movement today? What does that mean to you?
I think the women in my era worked hard. We were the forefront. I worked since I was 17 years old, and I always tried to work in a job with a union so that I would feel that I had equal access and equal opportunity and equal pay to every man. But at the time in 72, I worked for in a grocery firm, a very big grocery store that was union, and I can remember men saying to me on the workplace floor, well, you all wanted to burn your bras, now get used to the smell.
Oh, geez.
When they would schedule us maybe to an 11 o'clock shift or to a 10 o'clock shift, which, you know, sometimes had been not available to women because they were thinking that we'd all have to get home and cook dinner
right.
for our family.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. And Lori, if you can stay on the line, we'd love to get your contact info.
Sure.
Okay, thank you, Lori.
Uh-huh.
Let's go next to Roberta in Richmond. Hi, Roberta.
Hi. I'm just, I guess it's how far we've come, but not. in like the late 60s, I was in law school and I was one of the only women in law school, which has totally changed. And the teachers would make sport of giving any female a rape case or whatever thing would humiliate the students. I mean, that was just common. But the real thing I'm calling about is that I worked for an attorney, a.k.a. lawyer, in Illinois. And at that point, the law was you had to have one party guilty of unfaithfulness. And even though that was a fiction, if it were the woman accused of unfaithfulness, there was all kinds of ramifications. Even though everyone knew, it was a lie all the way around. The man had to be the one who was unfaithful. And that was the way you did divorces.
Right.
Lived on a fiction, and then they changed it. So those are two changes I just wanted to say are for the better now.
Yeah, much better. Actually, Stephanie writes about that in her book. And Roberta, same question to you. What are your thoughts about where we are today and the state of the women's movement today?
I see a lot of very positive things in terms of women feeling what we hope they would feel. You know, we can do whatever we want to do. Nothing will stop us. What I don't see is a sense of the reality that the glass ceiling still very much exists, that people who aren't privileged are in a totally different situation.
Right.
So I'm a little disheartened in some ways, in a lot of ways. But there are a group now of the people going to college now who really do have more of a sense. The generation before them I felt didn't and kind of scoffed at the women's movement. Feminist? I'm not a feminist.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Roberta.
Yes,
and Stephanie and Leslie, I'd love for you to comment on this because there's another great book, The Good Girls Revolt, about how the women of Newsweek magazine were not allowed to be reporters. These were middle upper class women who went to Ivy League schools and they sued. And on August 26, 1970, the 50th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, Betty Friedan called for a nationwide women's strike for equality. What really struck me about reading about this, August 26, 1970, the demands were equal opportunity in education and employment, a network of 24-hour free child care services, and then this is the one that really gets me, free abortion on demand. And Stephanie, I just, can you imagine people screaming free abortion on demand in the year 2013? Do we have Stephanie? Did we lose her again? Okay, well, we'll reconnect. What are your thoughts, Leslie? It's just, when you think about that in 1970, that these middle upper class women were calling for abortion on demand, and obviously other women.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And where we are today.
No, it's inconceivable that that would be a rallying cry.
So why, though?
I mean, I think what you've pointed to is really important. Access to abortion varies greatly. I don't have statistics in front of me, but I assume it varies greatly by class. And so if you have enough resources, you can get an abortion. You know, it's legal everywhere, so that has changed from 1973. But access to it where you are geographically makes a huge difference. So if you're in an urban area, you might have much more access. You know, broad swaths, though, of the middle of the country, you have no access. And but if you were an upper middle class woman in those areas, you could travel if you needed one. If you're poor, you can't. And so unfortunately, you know, those kinds of demands that, you know, Betty Friedan may be criticized for having focused so much on upper class women, but the movement at the time then, because all women were more oppressed, focused on the needs of all women in a way that I think is not as conceivable.
Well, Betty Friedan actually addressed this in a talk she gave. And so let's play a clip of Betty Friedan talking about these very issues.
To make it quite clear that this is not a bedroom war, that man is not the enemy, that sex is not the enemy, that marriage is not the enemy, that childbearing is not the enemy, but that what is the enemy is, in effect, the structure of society, which imprisons women in obsolete roles and denies them opportunities and challenges and experiences in society that would enable them to grow to their full human potential, enjoy the real human existence of full freedom and liberty, equality, and their own voice in the decisions of society and their future and even the decisions affecting their own bodies.
That is the voice of Betty Friedan, and thanks to the BBC for that clip. Stephanie, sorry we dropped you there, but I just was wondering, what do you think explains the fact that in 1970, women had no problem demanding free abortion on demand, and today you just would never hear that at a national rally?
Well, I think it's part of a larger question that I'd like to kind of go back to. When I was cut off, we were just talking about the fact that some women have benefited more than others from this revolution. And I think that what we've really seen is that in those days, the laws were so blatantly discriminatory that it was just important to win equality for women with men. And that meant, unfortunately, that you want equality if you're in the educated class or the upper class, you'd like equality with your men. If you were in the lower class, you'd at least like equality with the men in your class. And I think that was an important thing to do. But one of the things we have to recognize is that even though women have been making big gains in terms of equality, men as well. That we have a society where men don't have a lot of rights. I mean, men need paternity leave, and they need limits on their work weeks just like women do. We need, both women and men need higher wages so that you can actually raise a family and have time for family and not have to work two jobs. So I think one of the big challenges for feminism is to recognize that we have to go beyond and the demands for equality. And in some ways, I think when you raise this issue of reproductive rights, we have to start a new battle around the idea of the libertarian ideas that have spread. Because as women have become, there's been a sort of acceptance, even among people who are very socially and economically conservative, that women should have equal rights within their group. But they reject the idea that you should have any, that we have any kind of social responsibility to women or men or to families, as Leslie was talking about when I got cut off. So I think that we have to recognize that our battles are different right now. And one of the big challenges for feminism is to make sure that it's that we make it absolutely clear that this is a struggle for women and men. It's not just to bring women up to men. It's to bring women and men up and more equal.
And that is Stephanie Kuntz. She is author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique, and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. We're also joined by Leslie Bell. She's out with a new book, Hard to Get, 20-something Women and the Paradox of Sexual Freedom. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about where we are 50 years after the publication of the groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique. Betty Friedan frankly talked about the, quote, problem with no name and challenged the conventional role for suburban women as housewives and mothers. And I just want to read a few emails and then we'll get to callers. Marie writes, there's still an incredible war against women in this country, the patriarchy trying desperately to put women back in their place. Just talking about the example of having or not having children, the denial of abortions increasing, yet no support for the future mother during pregnancy and after having a child. European countries are further ahead. Free prenatal care, money's giving during pregnancy to help with expenses, money's giving to women for each child, time off with a partial salary, practically free child care. She says these are not recent laws. I'm 70. I'm from France. My mother received these services during my childhood. Thank you for that. Nancy writes, the Senate just passed the Violence Against Women Act with all of its inclusions. Thank you. That just happened today, right? The House, I think, just this morning, yeah. Thank you. And then Vivian writes, I got married last summer at the age of 39. I never felt societal pressure to get married, but my husband really wanted to. What I do feel is pressure to have children. I went to therapy to find my own voice and to distinguish that I don't want them. Even though my mother is a feminist and does not pressure me to have kids, and I live in San Francisco, a city with so few children, I still have a nagging voice in the back of my mind that there must be something wrong with me for feeling this way. It's strange that this pressure in society still exists, but at the same time, as you point out, Betty's book only came out 50 years ago. Thank you for the show. Well, thank you, Vivian. And as Leslie found, this is a huge pressure still.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, this pressure, the sense you need to be married by 30, have a child by the time you're 35. This is for educated women who, you know, are encouraged to develop their careers in their 20s. But the expectation is absolutely that this, you know, a child will necessarily come along. There are still a lot of assumptions about what it means to sort of be fully successful as a woman.
And I'm wondering, when you had these conversations with these women, and it is a diverse group of women, mm-hmm. did politics come up? Did they talk about issues that they advocate for, or was it mostly about their love and sex lives?
It's a great question. Some of them who just, you know, that was sort of their bent in life and, you know, worked in a nonprofit and were very political about whatever issue their nonprofit was advocating for. Some of them were, but in terms of the issues I was talking with them about what had happened in their sexual development and their relationship development, they saw it very much as, you know, related to their own personal individual history, as opposed to something that, you know, I heard a lot about instances of sexual assaults and rapes and
this is pervasive, right?
Extremely. Yeah. I mean, it was interesting when I was getting reviews from external reviewers for the book. One of them was saying, well, you need to address the fact that so many of these women appear to have been sexually assaulted. And so about 25% of the women I spoke with had some experience of either sexual assault or sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And that's on the high end, but it's not an outrageous proportion.
Right.
And no, those were definitely seen as, you know, particular to their own histories and not something that they felt particularly politicized about or that they thought about as coming from something structural.
What do you think about that, Stephanie?
Well, I do think that this is a real problem for young people today, that it's really difficult to see where the political structure comes from, you know, in a sense, in the 1960s, we picked the low-hanging fruit. You know, it's pretty easy to say, well, this is a law that blatantly discriminates against black people or discriminates against women. Let's overturn it. But how do you make demands about how to, I mean, now it's, rape is against the law. It's much easier to prosecute. It's not easy, and there's still lots of injustices. But how do you build a political program that speaks to the remnants of these kinds of power imbalances and cultural prejudices against women when we do have abolished the laws that actually support inequality and patriarchal attitudes? I think it's a tremendous challenge to young people, and it's no wonder that they often internalize this. And I, you know, if I had the answer, I'd be out there in another bedroom.
Well, and also,
I really don't, but I do think it's so important for us to choose targets, for example, such as fairness in work-family policies, and make sure that they are open to males as well as females, and we present them as human rights needs.
Well, we have just about 5 more minutes left, so let's go through a few calls, and then we'll get responses from Stephanie and Leslie. Let's go to Dorothy in San Francisco. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Most interesting program. I'm old enough to have experienced practically everything that you're talking about there in the early days. My touchstone book was The Female Eunuch by Germaine Greer, which I highly recommend. The point that I wanted to bring up was a bit of unfinished business, I think. That is the continued devaluing of older women, including by older women themselves. I remember as part of the empowerment of women in general in the feminist movement was the empowerment of older women and the you know, bringing up the archetype of the crone as the powerful older woman and the wise woman. And this seems to have gotten lost, at least to some extent. I'm 67. A lot of women my age are, you know, having plastic surgery until they look, you know, really rather grotesque because they have internalized the devaluing of themselves, really, as older women. And I thought that that was something worth mentioning, and I wanted to know what you thought about it.
Yeah, thank you so much. And just the way society treats women, there's a drastic exploding population of older homeless women in this country that's just now starting to get a little bit of attention. What are your thoughts on that, Stephanie?
Well, it's interesting. The Council on Contemporary Families just put out a little press release on mystiques, you know, mystiques that are still exist in honor of the 50th anniversary of the feminine mystique. And Paula England makes the point that a lot of the personal ones still exist, and particularly the age and beauty mystique, that men are considered to be attractive as they age, women are not. And the older a man is when he marries or remarries, the greater the age difference between him and his wife. And it's just not true for women. We don't see that. Although one of the things she points out is that this is yet another case where discrimination against women may not be in the long-range interest of men as well, because it turns out that in divorces, the younger person is much more likely to divorce the older person, not only a male who's younger, but also a female who's younger. So once again, a lot of these mystiques are really hurt both sexes. But for example, when we look at aging, yes, women are very much discriminated against by this beauty mystique. Men, on the other hand, are more lonely as they age, and white males, in the elderly males, have the highest suicide rate in the country because they're so isolated, and they're used to depending on women for their social network.
Wow, that would be a fascinating show. I had no idea. Thank you so much. Thank you for the call, Dorothy. Let's hear next from Shay in Felton. Hi, Shay.
Yes, hello. I want to thank you for taking my call and thank all of the sisters on the panel today. I just want to clarify that civil rights laws were not low-hanging fruit. People died for that stuff, and marched for that stuff, and I don't know. I feel this feeds into what I was going to say, which is that this was so wonderful. This whole program and everybody, you know, speaking about the gains and the struggles, and at the same time, I feel like we, once again, you know, 40 years later, we are leaving the little lesbian, dirty little lesbian sister in the closet because she's not acceptable. And it's like, the absolute expression of feminism is lesbianism. And I'm not saying that every woman should be a lesbian, but what I am saying is I don't hear anger. I don't hear, there are so many people getting shot in this country, black and white. There are so many kids getting beat up in their schools because they don't look right. It's like, I mean, I love you guys. Thank you for bringing this stuff up. Thank you for writing the books, because, but I, part of me is despairing, because it's like, wait a second.
Yeah.
We got to take the gloves off, and we're not all white and middle class, and let's bring up working class women and black women perfunctorily.
It's well, like, thank you. Shay, I hate to cut you off. We have about a minute left, but you make a really good point. And I wanted to also say that we did, well, at least try, to say that this book was really written for middle-upper-class white women.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts just quickly on that, Leslie?
So it's such a good point, Shay. And I'm sorry that we didn't get more of a chance to talk about this on the show. The sample of women that I spoke with was actually half queer, lesbian, and bisexual. And interestingly, even though they felt many of the same pressures, they of course felt them very differently, and they had different kinds of conflicts that manifested. But one of the most hopeful findings that I had is that actually the women who were able to kind of successfully navigate these conflicts and get more of what they wanted in terms of relationships and sex were my queer, lesbian, and bisexual respondents. And, you know, there are lots of ideas I have about what that may be about, some of which has to do with, you know, you have to have sexual agency if you're going to be with a woman. You can't be somebody who's not in touch with your desires. And so my challenge then for straight women would be to kind of see their partners as more similar to them than as somebody that they can just assume is going to be radically different from them.
Hmm. Maybe that's why there are so many single women out there right now, single straight women. Well, thank you so much. We will definitely continue this conversation. Leslie Bell, her new book is Hard to Get, 20-something Women and the Paradox of Sexual Freedom. And Stephanie Kuntz is author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
And thank you. Thank you so much for your phone calls and emails. Great stories. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the $85 billion mandatory cuts set to begin on March 1st and the right-wing corporate PR campaigns trying to influence budget talks. It's called Fix the Debt. We'll also discuss the parliamentary elections in Italy. We'll be joined by investigative journalist David K. Johnston, PR Watch's Mary Batari, and NPR's Sylvia Poggioli. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.